Okay, Cameron and Bob are back, and we're going into episode number 79, and we're going to the top of page 164 of my probe about what is the tech body. And we've come to the point in this article pamphlet of finding out what the hell is a tech body and what is that as opposed to the Android meme, and what does McLuhan mean by technology coming alive, which is the beginning point I like to take, or show that McLuhan was talking about something that became popular years later, I guess as discussed as virtual reality. So, Cameron and I were
we
just
should
talk-
note that it's the 7th of December.
Is that what it is? World War II?
Yeah.
Pearl Harbor?
7th of December, 2023.
Is there a reason you're citing the number?
Just that usually when we talk about the conversation we're having, we identify the date.
Okay. Well, just see me, give me a, what did you just say that I said, oh, that's what I want to talk about? Just say a few words, not the whole idea. What were the last words we said before we started recording?
Well, we mentioned that this on this page, 164, it gets down to...
Oh, the House of Dead, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're at top 164. We went over the Arthur Coker 1993 quote from Spasm last episode in 78. And then we're into section 5, is it? Where are we? I'm up there. 162. Isn't it about 160?
160 starts section 5.
Okay.
The anthropomorphic physical, the AP.
Right. So the AP is anticipates or is a figure for the tech body, even though it's the later stage of the Android meme. There's a overlap there. So I'm now
overlap
going down.
Between what?
Between the Android meme and the tech body, the AP comes in. And
my understanding of the AP is that the AP is a natural plurality, and that the Android meme and the tech body are both examples of the AP. Is that wrong?
Okay, I say the AP is the liberation of human scale up against these massive environments for a couple hundred years, and as they shrunk, what we call from Don Thiel the co-anesthetic, so that everybody is in the driver's seat in their blogging. We're at Web 2.0, it might even be Web 3.0, as people have command of everything digitally, which was the Android meme bigger than people in its early years, and 1.0 is now smaller, but it has, and so the idea that we got human scale, a lot of people project that's reestablishing the autonomy of the chemical body, the physical body. And that might be the neoconservatism or the alt-right celebrating original American Constitution and mm-hmm. anti-big government and all this stuff. That is a misnomer for what's going on, because you only have this feeling of superiority to your media environment through the holeopathic effect of the chip body. This is a delusion
right.
caused by the chip body. So,
yeah.
But it is a new effect. And so we're trying to define, I'm trying to figure out how to describe the AP and by showing how people misidentify with it. So,
right. So, but if I were to describe what you just described, I would say that, and to put it in McLuhan's terms, that what happens in the 20th century is that people come to understand that all human experience presupposes and immersion in the unconscious. And in the unconscious for McLuhan is a myriad of possibilities.
Oh, wait, so you flipped out. A myriad of what?
Possibilities.
Yeah.
Right? So they, at every instant, the human being is going into the unconscious and selecting out of the unconscious a way of looking at the world. So what you were just calling being in the driver's seat is what the human subject is in the unconscious, except that being in the driver's seat isn't conscious. Don't know that that's what they're doing. So we shouldn't understand this, the history that you're talking about, as something that is only sort of out there in the world. It's at the same time, it is interior. And what needs to be understood is the relationship between that outer history and the inner drama.
Yeah, so I give McLuhan credit for coming up with a 50% better definition of the unconscious as our extended environment, technology. So it goes beyond Freud, Jung, or Bateson, or anybody else that thinks the environment is some kind of unconscious. It's more particular, the environment as technologies. But I agree that these technologies, as they get pretty ethereal, you might be in a level of mind or what you call inner, that is not technologies like television and radio and these last phases of analog media that were objective, they seem, to people. So the objectivity has flipped, and that just occurs to me right now to say that may be why we start thinking something alive is growing out there, because we have displaced where the aliveness is, because we can't use our biology to use it as alive. Now, we might say our minds, but even that's questionable. So,
sure.
So your definition of the unconscious is what we're exploring, what we not sure what it is.
Right, and that applies also to the whole concept of what being alive means.
Yeah.
So what we're both in regards to the unconscious, in terms of being alive, in terms of being in the driver's seat, all these things emerge as questions. And the whole topic that we're getting into here is how does an individual and a society come to live with the possibilities before it.
And with awareness.
And
And so McLuhan said maybe original sin is not wanting to be aware. But I was telling some friends yesterday, earlier today on office hours, on Wednesday on the radio, that you can't use traditional meanings of awareness. None of the techniques in shaman land or yoga land or philosophy land about getting the population aware of something, that doesn't work. That's not what awareness is anymore. So awareness is part of the exploration here. What is awareness? What's the unconscious? What is conscious? What is the mind? And what is self-awareness of the mind? All those terms are what we're talking about. But you have to know that it's not too useful to quote anybody in the past as if they've solved it and we need to recover whatever they were talking about. So there's a whole democracy of contribution by anybody about discussing what we're supposed to be aware of, and that is what the blogosphere, the Web 2.0, the everybody in the driver's seat, they all got their anthropomorphic notions of what awareness is or what human is or where we should be getting to.
Correct.
And, of course, that would be past, present, future, because you can evoke images from the past or possibilities in the future or the present. That is the extent of what we're questioning. And if you really see that, you might shut up and just see what mistakes people are making who don't shut up and what they think they're trying to say. You're ready to not respond positively to what they're saying because they haven't recognized the need for silence. Or
correct.
to Correct. Recognize
all,
it's really hard
correct.
To talk about this. Oh, yeah. What are you saying?
I'm saying that what you've been talking about for the last 2 minutes, I think is 100% correct, except where you started. And where you started, you said that McLuhan regarded original sin as the failure to be aware.
Yeah.
But I think McLuhan regarded original sin as the deception of being aware.
Yeah.
For McLuhan, we have to realize that awareness is, at the end of the day, is extremely questionable. That the human ability to be aware at bottom never comes to an end. It's always subject to exploration. It's always subject to ambiguity. It's always subject to new definition. So go ahead.
Yeah, so the dialectic is most people, especially in the West, think going back to something in books is awareness. And they're up against people who recognize the fallacy of that, but they don't get the possibilities, the advantages, or how to talk about the post-book. And so you got maybe liberals are pro-post-book, and conservatives or ecologists are pro-book. And that's the conflict here in media terms. And the liberals are, because they don't know to study McLuhan and maybe the men of 1914, to recognize that what they think is coming, you know, what are those guys called? The trans, the optimists, the trans technology. They want to chop their heads off, have their head preserved, and then someday technology can reawaken their head. What are those guys called?
Well, you're talking about the people that get frozen when they
die?
Yeah.
There's a term for them. Years ago, and anyways, the transformation cult, the hoping that technology will save you, that's what the quote liberals are for. They think Trump, the right wing, are troglodytes trying to grab something in the past that they know doesn't apply. But they don't seem to be sophisticated enough to know why that doesn't apply. They don't see the technological changes and the grounds and the laws of that you can figure out, put in order what happened in the past and avoid the ideological, political arguments. The Gutenberg guys think that's a lot of pipe dreams. So they're both inadequate. And we're not talking within either one of them. We're trying to say there is a tradition, or there is something that's been developed that gets to the issue of what we're supposed to be aware of, or what we're supposed to recognize is our unconscious. Any of those terms. That's what we're talking to. Now, I think some of the quote liberals might think they're talking about it when they get into virtual reality or Ray Kurzweil says machines are spiritual, you know. There is an attempt to grasp it. So let's go for this quote to see if I come up with anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fire away.
Okay. Top of 164. As we move into the more extreme case of the present cloned ESP environment. Okay. That's an interesting phrase, cloned ESP. So McLuhan said in the 50s, electronics is ESP, but then you have the digital extension of the analog electric ESP, which actually takes the analog ESP and manufactures it quickly all over the world with the simulated societies, quick propped up environments in the third world. And so they're cloning the analog ESP environment. I think that's what I mean. The cloned ESP, the cloning of the analog ESP by something that can manipulate it. In other words, it's a ground, which we call virtual reality or the digital or AI. So the present cloned ESP environment is not enough. That's why I add and the tech body. The more extreme case of the present cloned ESP environment, that Croker sort of writes about that, so that's what we've been for the last 30, 40 years. But there's something new that is making people think that our control of the cloned ESP environment is not working. So that's the tech body. So as we move into this dialectic between the cloned ESP and the tech body, perhaps Finnegan's Wake will stay the course, in other words, slow us down, as the non-now echoes Frank Zappa's concept of xenocrony. Let's see, do I give a definition? Go down to footnote 64. Where are my footnotes?
At the bottom of the page.
Right, okay.
So that refers to an article in Wikipedia.
Hmm. Okay, so I'm going to have to explain it a bit. So Zappa would, with his computerized studio, he had lots of recordings of concerts. And so he would take a drum solo from one concert, one song, and then a guitar solo from another song, nothing to do with the first song, and want them to clash, put them together, trying to create dissonance. And he often found, according to his ears, they meshed and resonated together and were consonant, you would say, rather than dissonant.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a strange synchronization. Xeno means strange. Strange synchronization that he was trying to avoid. Now, I took that...
trying to avoid or trying to enact?
He's trying to avoid synchronicity. Zappa, half of him wanted to upset people with his sound.
Ah, okay.
Which is might be his way of being an anti-environment. And so he would be satirical with his sound. And but he also said he would relieve that dissonance with consonance and know that you bring in nice, whatever, harmony melodies or what he called the harmonic climate.
Right, right. Yeah.
To,
so this is what's interesting about what you're saying there for me is that McLuhan always insists on discontinuity.
Yeah.
But discontinuity would not be discontinuity if it excluded continuity.
Right.
Because if discontinuity ate ATE, if it ate continuity, then there would only be discontinuity and it wouldn't be discontinuity anymore.
That's right. Okay. So, I was aware of Frank having this strange synchronization. And in a cloned ESP environment, I said the digital, Web 2.0, allowed one to disconnect from the analog ESP of television and radio, first half of the 20th century, where there's a kind of a hive mind already, rather than a digital hive mind. And Web 1.0 allowed everybody to participate in the analog, have a sense of being detached from it, atomization was their term, and therefore engage in the analog cloned ESP voluntarily. So I had voluntary ESP was subsuming the cloned ESP, the hive mind effect of analog TV. Or the global theater under early satellite conditions. So the digital or the virtual enhanced autonomy or created the effect of autonomy, and that therefore you didn't have to engage. You didn't have to watch something like everybody else. It's very simple. You could record something, watch it later in your own time. So the synchronization of people discussing what was on TV, that old cliche at the office, became harder to maintain because people were recording and seeing it at a different time than the other people in the office. So apparently that made people who are naturally social at work as a stress relief, right? You're working, and then the sociality, the coffee break or whatever they do. I remember reading that in factories in the 90s, people would go outside and fuck on their break, which would be a natural development of the break, you know. Nobody had, quote, morals anymore, so you just got fucked whenever you could. and maybe a lot of people weren't even married. So that, okay, what was that? That's the desire for sociality, the pros and cons of it. You could disconnect from it more with voluntary ESP and digital technology.
We should point out how the images that you're talking about here are things that are going on in the world. So factory workers, for example,
yeah.
They're working in the factory, they're taking breaks and all this sort of stuff. But there's also a mind looking at these factory workers and what they're doing. And as the mind looks on at this, it's almost like a movie or something,
yeah,
of people working in the factory. That mind that's looking at this is also developing itself. And so you're always talking about two things happening at the same time.
Yes.
There's a historical objective dimension, and there's an ahistorical subjective dimension. And these things are meshed in that they're never independent of each other. But how they are meshed is not conscious. And
that's sociality. The effects of social being are the unconscious. And the mind is reacting. It doesn't want to merge with everything. It wants to maintain some kind of separateness, which would be the anthropomorphic physical or the autonomy. What did Buber call it? The I and the thou, you know? That interplay of people, which is all the tension in media. So you're right to say there's a part of your being, call it mind, and maybe that's what I mean by software, is not embedded in hardware. But because the hardware and software, as McLuhan spells out in Take Today in 1972, is merging, it's getting harder to say what you're detached from. And that's probably where you start projecting that some technology is getting out of control and it's becoming alive, because you can't really even notice where your unconscious is. So that confusion is increasing, you know, since Web 1.0. So then I was saying, what was I just saying before that? I was reading here. Oh, Xenocrony. So,
yeah. So
Zappa's there. Something is interfering with his orderly attempt to create dissonance. He can't even make dissonance. Something keeps synchronizing. So then, when Zappa died, I heard this is the anniversary. It was December 4th, 30 years ago in 93. So a week or so after, she was on local radio. Some rock critic interviewed her about it. And she said that Frank would often think up a song or something, and then he would see news events out there, odd news events, that mirrored his song. So there was some so I got from that they noticed there was a synchronizing with his creativity in the something out there. Now, mm-hmm. I found that very interesting because that was my experience.
Yes.
First triggered, I've mentioned it, I think, before, when Nelson told me, Nelson Thal, in mid-80s or so, he was in Toronto when the Blues Brothers were being made, and he met Belushi and the other guy, Aykroyd. And so he was looking at it in the late 80s, and he said, well, geez, they're dancing like Bob. He had seen me dance. And so you dance like Bob, or Bob, you dance like them. So I looked at it and I said, that's interesting. And I had noticed other synchronicities in my behavior and in the media, but I didn't look for it. Other people pointed out. So I call that a strange synchronicity. So I adopted Frank's term, Xenocrity, for my own personal meaning. In other words, I was not attempting to be tuned into things. I thought that was a bit obsolete. I was trying to not engage in ESP. I understood, well, you got to do volunteer ESP. So I was not trying to sync up with anything. And I thought Zappa was trying to do that in his music, but he kept getting sucked in. So I said, yeah, I keep getting drawn in, you know, like the guy in Godfather, Al Pacino. I'm getting drawn in is how his complaint in Godfather 3 at the beginning, because he's trying to be respectable. So I get being drawn in, and people are telling me, you're right in the middle of this clone DSP, Bob. Your image keeps showing up. So this happened more and more as I developed different media phenomena through the hundreds of hours of engaging in media that at least a few people would notice. So I'm taking Zenarchrony as something unique to me. People, the average Joe is out there seeing what he can identify with. And so on my Facebook page, no, my original site before Facebook, well, 2005, fivebody.com, I had people in there, and they would engage with me, but they would start seeing themselves in different places, or they would try to see themselves. They thought that's what I meant, that I was trying to see myself. And I said, no, I'm not. But they didn't get that. They would see themselves and say, wow, that synchronized with me. So they were into synchronicity, electric synchronicity. They were catching up to the clone DSP thing. They weren't into voluntary disconnection, voluntary ESP. So I was surprised to hear that Frank and Gail noticed that happening in Zappa. So I said, okay, if you're a powerful creator, maybe the environment, this living Android meme, responds to somebody who's powerful, who understands what the hive mind is going through in the clone DSP and is trying not to engage it. Therefore, the Android meme takes that as a challenge and then starts showing you yourself in the media. So he would see his songs there. So I started seeing this more and more. And there was a guy named Brian Taylor. He, if you look at my Dobbstown.com and listen to my interview with him 2008 or 9 or so, he was a guy who used to listen to me on CKLN and all that. And he started having synchronicity himself. But it often happened when he was engaging me. So he was an interesting guy who was understanding the Zenarchrony I was going through, understood how it was not the synchronicity he was experiencing, but he couldn't deny that I was affecting him somehow. So that's an interesting dialogue. And Brian is now, what is this, it's 15 years later, is a member of the Office Hour show. And he will bring in this weird synchronicity he has with me, but knowing I'm not trying to have that. So he's a good updater of this drama that is, dialoguing with me, trying to figure out what I mean by Zenarchrony. So let's say that's enough to say that and go back to this point where I'm bringing this point in to say that Zappa's strange Zenarchrony. So I say, Finnegan's Wake will stay the course as the non-now echoes Frank Zappa's concept of Zenarchrony, which then leads to my concept of Zenarchrony. And that's what the Tiny Note chart is. It's this Bob Zenarchronous decade dance or something echoes the Grand Wazoo's big note. So I call it Bob Zenarchronous Tiny Note. So I'm making Zappa's Zenarchrony a ground of the Android meme, which my Tiny Note chart is a picture of, made in 1995, instead of saying it's about me, but the title does have me in there. So I'm trying to show you my Zenarchrony. So granted, we don't know what I mean if you're just first reading this. What the hell? How does the non-now echo Frank Zappa's concept of Zenarchrony? Probably the non-now is how you talk about this synchronous that must include the diachronic, but it's not the diachronic. What you had just said 5 minutes ago is a way of saying it's not just a big now. You have to include the non-now or the non-time in here. So these are words that admittedly aren't understandable. I'm not pretending this is understandable. It is an attempt to say something, you might call it poetry, right? Poetry exceeds our grasp. So then I say...
They don't explicate themselves.
Right. I got to go by a kind of intuition. Who can intuit something? Which means some strange new weird thing that's going on. There seems to be a common agreement in the popular expression of wherever you see popular expression, in the news or in the blogs, there seems to be a growing concern or perception that something weird is going on. And some people call it AI, but a lot of people aren't sophisticated and don't think of it that way. They just say, my life doesn't make sense anymore. Though they're not despondent to all the time, they're intrigued by this seductive weirdness that's happening. Okay, so that makes everybody addictive to what's going on and texting and monitoring the media, right, to see where we're at. This is their identity, is to see what they can see of themselves, their own AP, in an environment that they think must have anthropomorphic physical in there. They can't believe it's totally disconnected from humans, and therefore there's no anthropomorphic physical in there anymore. That's probably so. In my chart, the anthropomorphic physical is a bit of a resistance, you could say, a bit of sentimentality, of hoping for some kind of point of awareness that makes you feel not totally swallowed up. So I think that's you. Do you agree with me that there's a lot of expression of that in the average opinion about I'm being swallowed up, and I don't know if I'm going to ever get out of it. Have you ever heard that feeling? Do you agree that that's a mood out there?
Sure. It's I think that has been going from very, very intelligent people early in the 20th century.
Yeah.
Let's say the men of 1914. Their notion of Western civilization coming into a cul-de-sac has... over the following century, become a general conception.
Right. We come back to that quote from McLuhan in Playboy in 1970, that the auditory imagination has become common awareness by 1970, but Finnegan's Wake hasn't. We have now got to Finnegan's Wake as the common awareness. Not that they know that, but it is... It's post-auditory imagination, you might call it the tactile imagination, is best expressed by Finnegan's Wake. So in other words, McLuhan said 50 years ago, we had not got to where you're saying, and I'm saying we got to right now, what the tactile men of 1914 started to pick up. 100 years later, it's a common awareness. Now, how do you make people aware that that's what they're aware of and they don't know? The literary antecedents. Do you need to know about Finnegan's Wake? That's so I say perhaps Finnegan's Wake will stay the course or help us stay the course to the common mood, the collective consciousness you just expressed has happened now on a big scale, wide scale. Okay? So that's partly what I'm talking about. And that includes people feeling something as synchronistic with their life a lot. It's not hard to get people, if you bring up synchronicity, they say, yeah, that happened to me when I watched this movie or I'm watching TV or some kind of information environment. They seem to have the synchronicity. Now, I'm saying that I'm not subject to that, but you'll think that you'll see me in the media more and more. That's because I'm synchronous, not synchronicity. I'm really good at not being swallowed up in the clone DSP, but I still can't escape it. So I cite Zappa because I found out from his wife that he was, it was something they talked about, that his creativity was echoed out there. What is the title of my tiny note? Bob Synchronous Tiny Note. I have the Graham Wazoo's, I guess I have to bring it up, the actual title of my tiny note. Let's see, do I have it really easy here to see? Just a second. I want to show you how I have Zappa and myself in the chart. Okay, here it is. Yeah, the title is, I have at the very top, A Chain Letter of Phase Shifts. Then in bigger letters, Xenochronous Bob's Tiny Note equals the Grand Wazoo's Decade hyphen Dance. The Grand Wazoo is a Zappa concept, what he named his band at one point when it was the beginning of rock jazz fusion. He called his band the Grand Wazoo. And then he writes a story about, you know, the head of a secret society like the Shriners, the Freemasons, the Grand Wazoo's decadence. But I'm saying it's a decade dance every 10 years. It shifts. It's a phase shift. And then the subtitle of that is A Cyclotron of Homeopathic Cliché Probes, Wherein Causes Merge with Effects. So that's what I'm trying to show. And a simple phrase is tactility, because when Zappa was asked, is the culture mirroring TV or is TV mirroring the culture? He says, well, they overlay. It's hard to tell which is which. And McLuhan expressed that when he said he didn't know whether the message was the medium or the medium was the message. He found it hard to figure out what the medium was. That's your unconscious. More and more of the unconscious is right in around you, and you can either accept it and be a robot and go along with it, or try to separate yourself from it. But to separate yourself from it in Gutenberg terms doesn't work, and it doesn't necessarily work in virtual terms or whatever they mean by AI. Okay, so that's what I say about what I'm saying in that first sentence. Okay, the next sentence. The early 21st century can be perceived as a digital/mobile phase of voluntary ESP, a celebration of pinhead consciousness/intelligence rather than simply discarnate connected tactile intelligence. So I'm always taking on de Kirchhoff's concepts in his books in the 90s. I always felt he had no clue what was going on and that he was a simple retrieval of McLuhan and not using the deeper McLuhan. I claimed that I had a sense of the deeper McLuhan. And I later realized you, through talking to you, you have a deeper sense of McLuhan than anybody else. So this is what I'm saying, a celebration of pinhead consciousness. In other words, not able to become aware, but it's a kind of intelligence rather than simply discarnate connected tactile intelligence. Discarnate connected tactile intelligence is the clone DSP analog environment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's the content of the digital. The digital is a pinhead consciousness. So then I say, in this complex culture of tactility in extremis, which means it's tactility squared by the Android meme. The Android meme is tactile. It's overlaying the clone the ESP of electronics in the first half of the 20th century that the men of 1914 were dealing with. McLuhan started to perceive the squaring of this tactility in the digital or computer world, what he called technology coming alive. So that's a complex culture of tactility in extremis. Then I say see, but you can't just see it, so it has to be in quotes, see Frank Zappa's musical concepts. In other words, I'm saying go back to Xenochrony and read what he says about time and spherical reality and Xenochrony. In this complex culture, we've witnessed the phrase artificial/virtual intelligence lose its charisma. Yeah, whatever we thought we were moving towards, you know, in the 90s, information longs to be free, you know, that Grateful Dead songwriter guy, he led the Electronic Frontier organization. He had Wired magazine. There was, as usual, when new technology happens, there's a utopian celebration of it. And then the disservices show up. So that's partly what I mean is the wonders of AI that they were trying to figure out, part of it being the Human Genome Project, and that failed. They didn't get what they thought they would get. That was an 80s thing. It lost its charisma. AI has lost its charisma. We're now just worried about it. So I'm saying the ground of that losing its charisma is the tactility squared thing. So I could just quote you and say, the unconscious is proving more unconscious than we thought it would be. We thought we would become conscious of the unconscious and have an awareness. Now, what's interesting is McLuhan says we do have collective intelligence, collective consciousness in the analog phase of the global theater in the 60s, but we did not understand what the implications of that were, and at best, we thought it was a Gutenberg retrieval. This is what you see in Bob Logan's books. I remember him in his, he had a book, what, the fifth language, the sixth language, he had a couple of books like that as the digital unfolded in the 90s. And he was saying, you know, reading's coming back. Do you remember that? Or did you even not know about his books?
I didn't read them.
Yeah, well, that's what he would say. He'd celebrate people were reading again. And that is the fourth school of mediacology in my long essay on the six schools of mediacology. That's the diasporic school. That's the Neil Postman, the Lance Straight, the Bruce Powell, Frank Zingroni, not so much Frank, let's put him aside. Who else was it? William Irwin Thompson, Bruce Powell, Neil Postman, and de Kirchhoff. They were hip on the electric effects, as McLuhan laid them out, but they really deeply valued Gutenberg values. And they wondered if they'd ever get the humanities back, or the Gutenberg back. And they couldn't accept, like McLuhan did, we're not getting it back. So they futilely become popular because the population is yearning to get the Gutenberg back, whether they know it or not. I call that the diasporic school. They're all literate guys, and they didn't get together and form a movement like me and Nelson did on the radio using an electric medium. They just bemoaned their situation individually. It's interesting, Don Thiel would agree with me. He was more on my side. He considered Neil Postman a thug, a guy that the CBC would keep interviewing with his Gutenberg values and ignore someone like Don Thiel, who could describe the digital reality better using Finnegan's Wake than Postman or anybody. But they didn't have him. They wouldn't have him on. So I think that pissed Don off a bit, but he knew if he got on, it would be pretty futile. Anyways, he joined me and Nelson. We formed the McLuhan Institute. I don't know if you ever hear that, the Para-McLuhan Institute in 2000 or so. Did you ever see that?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, we formed it in 2001 after 9/11 with some movers and shakers in Toronto. But Thiel was our eminence grease in it. And it was just me and Nelson trying to get something going beyond ourselves on the radio. Okay, so so we're groping for what McLuhan really meant. And your little talk at the beginning about the unconscious and what is the unconscious, I think you need to understand that technologies are the unconscious, but then the technologies have evaporated. We're not sure what is technology and what is human anymore. So that's a bit past McLuhan's definition or important insight that our real technology, our real unconscious is the environment created by new technologies. Thiel told me that a word that became popular in the 90s in academia, advanced academia, was techne. It seemed that technology was not a good word to use, so they went back and found techne, and that would be another way of discussing virtual reality. Did you know that, the use of the word techne?
Yeah, that comes from Heidegger.
Right, so Heidegger was a popular guy among the Gutenberg academics, yet seemed to be pointing to something that 19th century literate people didn't recognize. So techne was the new term rather than technology. So for those that went with techne, McLuhan's language was obsolete. But then they're looking for language. They're looking for communication and to get some kind of authoritative position to justify them being at the head of the class teaching to a bunch of other people who are involved with the same dilemma as the teacher is. Okay, so but that's what I'm trying to say here, in a way. In this complex culture of tactility in extremis, see Frank Zappa's musical concepts, which were really tactile concepts, we've witnessed the phrase artificial intelligence or virtual intelligence lose its charisma. Now, would you agree that I'm on to something saying, say the Android meme level or virtual reality has lost its charisma of the 90s? What do you think?
Sure. No, I think I relate to what you've been talking about for the last 5 minutes or so in not only in terms of developing technology out there in the world, but also what the subjective person in the driver's seat learns from looking at these objective possibilities. Because these objective possibilities are environments that are birthed or genetically encoded in the unconscious.
Right.
And so human beings are being, over this history, human beings are being driven to understand a very difficult problem.
Yeah.
Of being in the driver's seat, which is not only an active role, it's also a passive role.
Yeah.
And so it's a very difficult figure where the...
That's what I mean by pinhead consciousness, the passive part.
Yes. Well, and also you mean that pinhead consciousness, as in the diasporic school that you were just talking about, it thinks that it can relate to sort of independent concepts in order to reach the conclusions that put it at the head of the class, as you just said.
Yeah.
But the problem is that there aren't such things as independent pinhead concepts. Everything flows into everything else.
And that's so that Finnegan's Wake is a painting of that.
Absolutely. So then the question is, how does the mind, either individually or collectively, how does human being come to terms with this emerging demand on consciousness? It's a demand on consciousness that cannot be controlled by consciousness. It's a demand made on consciousness that is received, that is passive. And how consciousness can go through a kind of somersault to come to terms with this driven passivity is sort of the great question hanging over everything today.
Right. And the Gutenbergs try to reestablish will or independence or some kind of separateness. And you would never.
That's why the term diaspora is so good.
Yeah.
Right? A diaspora is a disconnect.
Yeah. And you would never even desire to have that separateness because it cannot be achieved. But it is a problem to be totally merged, at least historically for the West. People like to say, well, the Chinese are pretty good at being zombies, you know, because they were kind of like that. Well, that would be, they did not have the Gutenberg effect in them. But they don't seem to be balanced, even though they have the advantage of their tactility. The Asians have that's one thing about the counterculture. It's attracted to tactility, and a lot of it goes east. It's interested in different variations of non-Western culture, maybe even Southern and Third World cultures, Aboriginal cultures, often includes drug taking. That's a celebration of merging into the tactility, but you're just being I don't know if that's a problem. Could be a problem. Some people make it a problem. And that's another thing is you don't make things a problem. But then there's a lot of resistance to that. Got to have a problem. Okay, so anyways, we're doing a good job of making incomplete syllables. We're not completing our syllables. We're keeping up with Biden. Trump is old fashioned. He didn't complete his sentences. We're pretending we're speaking in sentences, but actually we're syllabizing. So then I go,
correct,
quite a mysterious and devastating implication that nobody was expecting from the global theater. What I just said, the complex culture, you lose, AI lost its charisma. I'm saying that's quite a mysterious and devastating implication nobody was expecting from the global theater.
Right. Let me just say there that the reason that it's a mysterious and devastating implication is that the global theater implicates roles, but it turns out that the roles are self-dissolving. So that's why it's a mysterious and devastating implication.
Yeah, and your audience is self-developing. You're not sure who your role is for.
Correct.
So I let's see if I say that in the next sentence. The greatest disservice that was foreseen was the evocation of desperation and urgency in national, tribal, and personal identity. Okay, that identity quest is what the fuck role am I doing that I think I'm doing? So the greatest disservice that was foreseen was the evocation of desperation and urgency in national, tribal, and personal identity quests that created a more violent mood in the 70s, 80s. Now, that's because your image of the role you think you got to make doesn't – you don't recognize that there's no stage for your role. You can have a role, but only for 6 months. That the demand on changing your roles, which I call later quadrophenia, is something that humans can't deal with. You know, McLuhan said, we can't live with this stuff. That's a big deal. Give up your job, get a role, but the roles don't satisfy you either because there's too many mood shifts and too many different audiences servicing. You know, Ted Carpenter and McLuhan talk about this in their book, They Became What They Beheld, about 1970 or 71, that book came out. And they're talking about new media creates new roles and new audiences. And the young people were responding to new audiences. That leads to video art and performance art. But that's long lost its charisma because if everything becomes a role, then there's no roles. And then if there's something keeps shifting what the theater seems to demand, the stage keeps shifting, that begins to look like something beyond human is running the show.
Correct.
What were you calling it?
Which?
What was running the show? You had to be passive to.
Yeah.
So there's a great passivity going on. And some would call it apathy.
It's what McLuhan attributed to the satellite.
Yeah. Yeah, so, the end of nature. And
yes, end of ground.
Right. So, you know, they say 70% of people don't vote. That's good. That's passive. So to demand, to say that our civilization is falling away and we have nothing new to grasp on is to miss the changes and adaptations that McLuhan said the audience always does. They can't describe it anymore, but they're adapting. In other words, we haven't blown ourselves up yet. Something is stopping that.
Sure. So one of the reasons that McLuhan was a Catholic convert was that he had this idea that every extreme reverses itself. So he believed that in going to hell, the world was also saving itself.
Right. There's always these flips. So he counted on the flips, and he knew they were happening faster and faster. So in some ways, he had nothing more to say. He had figured out how to handle what was going on, at least personally, and he didn't develop his probes as much in the 70s. He had a few he developed, but that's just like looking like he's participating and coming up with useful stuff. But there was an increasing passivity that he said was the answer back in understanding media. Now, the audience has become passive in many ways. They could say non-judgmental, while the minority Android meme screams and demands people to become judgmental. Become aware, to wake up, to not appreciate, to not go with this trend. We're drifting. So that screaming, Don Thiel said, is what Joyce satirized in Finnegan's Wake. All through the book, there's demands to wake up, and he's making fun of these hysterical efforts to wake up because they're always inadequate in what they think has to be awakened.
Correct. So that's a big theme in Lewis.
Okay, in Paleface?
Yes.
Which is what, 1929 book, 1930?
Yeah, but written in, most of it appeared earlier in 27.
Right, and he probably wrote it in that 1,500-page thing he did in 1924, 25, right? A Man of the World.
A lot of it, yeah.
So he watched, in 1922, he sees Eliot becoming famous, he sees Joyce becoming famous, and he's not becoming famous. And he knows he's inspired those two guys. So he was forced into a passivity, or he's going to be ruled. So he writes The Art of Being Ruled in there at the beginning. He was starting to maybe save his anthropomorphic physical, save his identity, by making something out of not being creative. Men without art was not a problem. But he still had a problem. He still couldn't give it up completely. So, but I'm just realizing now that he was beginning to celebrate and maybe the first to recognize the passivity, because your creativity would always be outdone by the new developments in technology. Couldn't keep up with it. What do you think of that? That he perceived the passivity. And so he's very passive in 22, 23, and then all these ideas or criticism that he could express, showing his not being fooled by the demands of the present, which he called time. So he criticized every creative effort in science, sociology, philosophy, and art, and literature. He went after all of them because they weren't part of this new passivity. And he would often say the passivity recognizes that the environment is doing something that is more important than any private creativity going on in art or science.
Right. We have to recognize that a word like passivity has many different meanings.
Yeah.
So Lewis criticized passivity in the sense of people not being aware of what the hell they were doing, especially when they were moralizing, especially
yeah,
when they were...
I try to show this to the Widow Lewis Society members. I don't think they get it. They still think he's a writer. They don't get that Lewis is pointing out a post-writer situation. That's why his books were, quote, superficial. Just conversational, winging it, and sniping at people. And it irritates those that want a deeper literary concept. And you see that in the Lewis group. You know, the POB people, print-oriented bastards, are frustrated with the superficiality of Lewis, but they can't say it's wrong. They can't say they like the titillation and all kinds of interesting patterns he gives. See, because that's the present, is pattern addiction. A pattern addiction, pattern recognition, is the endless percept we're in. And that threatens people's passivity. They get excited about a pattern they got. And then they form a movement out of it. That's probably Pound's problem. He got a big pattern out of social credit, Douglass's economics, and then he fucking harped on that for 20 years until he heard Bucky Fuller. Then he recognized, according to Kenner, oh, maybe I missed something. He got so active, he got on the radio and became a treasonous person, right?
Yep.
And Joyce was understanding eventually the passivity because he said, let Hitler take over. He wasn't going to resist it. He had to resist it. He had to run and escape. But conceptually, perceptually, he knew there was something to Lewis's passivity. Though Lewis looked very active and in the 30s was trying to help the Jews and everything, he was very active and hoping to have peace. But he also knew war was coming. So again, it really was hard to write prose without turning into Finnegan's Wake. You know?
I don't know that I would say that Lewis writes in a superficial way.
No, no. People find, and this is what's good about a Wyndham Lewis Society, you get a bunch of people reading his books. Everybody seems to see that he's playing with us. He doesn't come up with a solution. He contradicts himself all the way through the book, and that bothers them. That effect of Lewis's writing is undeniable. That's what's going on there. And so I'm putting in quotes that that appears superficial to people. It's not, he should stop contradicting and come to his point. What is your goddamn point, Lewis? Nobody can figure out what his points are in all these books.
But I personally think that's something that also happens in McLuhan, and it's where Lewis and McLuhan say things that they see as obvious, and in fact are obvious, but the whole world can't see it.
Right.
So if we read Lewis today, especially the nonfiction books of the late 20s,
yeah,
Art of Being Ruled, Time in Western Man, Paleface, those books set out where we are right now today.
Yes.
In 2023.
And his 30s books do that too, if you stay with them and read them.
Personally, I haven't read those yet, so I have to look forward to that.
Yes.
But for 100 years, people could not see what was obvious to us in the late 1920s.
Yeah, the themes, we'd gone into the electric eternity. The themes that he saw that he was wrestling with, they would not go away under electric conditions, so they'd still be here because we're under electric conditions.
Yeah, well, I would say it's because they're always the case that it's a synchronic happening that he's talking about. And so it's as true in 1926 as in 2023.
Right. So that's where you go. You could retrieve Aristotle, pre-Socratics, Aboriginals. That's when you get
Absolutely.
Into the now, which you're calling synchronic. And the electric gets us out of the diachronic progressive Gutenberg illusion.
Correct.
So apparently human history has been largely synchronic. The Gutenberg is a short phase, and the electric age, electric eternity is putting us back into that again. So that's the eternal problems that everybody's wrestling with. And
yeah, but you can't say that that history is largely synchronic as opposed to diachronic. It's always both.
Right.
So the great test is whether a person can sort of roll with the synchronic genesis of the diachronic. And
the genesis of the diachronic is what you said.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you look at the world situation today, the great contest is unipolarity and multipolarity. But before you were talking about East and West.
Yeah.
So the East, represented by Russia, China, BRICS, et cetera, they rest upon the idea of multipolarity, which is non-judgmental
passivity.
Passivity.
Non-judgmental passivity.
All right. We can say that. They accept the governance of countries as the business of those countries and not to anyone else. And the unipolarity is the idea that there's a rule-based order, as they say, that is the rule for everybody.
Yes.
Very Gutenbergian concept.
Yes, so it's important to understand that the diachronic doesn't go away, and that it was good to go through the diachronic to create a different environment, therefore a different awareness, to get out of the eternity of acoustic and tactile spaces before. So when we come back, we have not the retrieval of the diachronic, but the diachronic doesn't go away, which is what McLuhan used to say. So the mm-hmm. diachronic is there in the synchronic, which you keep
Correct.
Saying.
Yeah.
So I attempted exactly. to explain what that was, is that we went through the diachronic, a big error, a fallacy, but it was necessary to infect the retrieved big now, the synchronic. So seeing that clearly, that makes you passive. I can watch a movie or read a book, or neither. Go surfing or something.
No matter what a person does, reading a book, going surfing, whatever, is always a possibility that is before the individual, before both in a spatial and a temporal sense. So it's not possible for anybody to do something that's not a pre-existing possibility. So in regards to
you can't
to
be original in that sense. The Gutenberg
Correct.
Idea, desire to be original.
Right. So that in that sense, everybody is passive.
Yes.
But there is a strange kind of creativity that goes with that passivity, and that we're not necessarily doomed to living out passivities that are handed to us. The world of advertising, the world of the deep state, etc., wants to assume the role of assigning passivities. And the big
that'd
question
be the rules.
Is whether...
Right, that's the yeah. preserving the rules. That's maybe political correctness. The different correctnesses are silly.
Correct. Yeah, so the big question is whether or not humans are going to be able to acclimatize themselves to this strange knot, K-N-O-T, of activity and passivity.
Yeah.
And the jury is out. Nobody knows if human beings can stand that sort of responsibility.
Yeah, can they stand it that there's no finish line? It's not resolved which posture is correct. So
correct.
This is where journalism is a huge disservice. They're always pointing out problems and endlessly discussing them now with the Web 2.0. There's nothing but people yakking away about this shit, and they should shut up. But it's the way for the West to make money. People get paid for typing and talking. That's the
right.
big deal. Get your role going, and you get an audience, and you get paid for it. That's really irresponsible. But I'm not going to panic about it, right? I'm not going to get upset about it, but I'll say, buddy, I'm not inviting you over here. I'm not interested in what you have to fucking say. You can go on yakking away. You can be Tucker Carlson and get everybody activated, all worked up. It's a lot of noise, and I can handle it, and you can't. The guys that can't handle – the guys making the noise, they can't handle the silence. They can't handle the noise. I am declaring something. I've arrived at there, Cameron. I'm successfully handling the noise.
Yes. Well, I mean, to be alive means to be located in the space between noise and silence.
Yes.
So it's a.
You know, there's a magazine in 2000, issue number 22 of Paranoia magazine, has me on the cover, and it says, "The only man alive today." And I meant what you just said. I was between the noise and the silence. That's probably what I meant.
Sure. And that's to situate yourself in tactility.
Yes. And co-anesthetic in the driver's chair, driver's seat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I actually activated that accidentally, where I'm now actually what they're all fighting over, what I've created, the practical, the breakthrough. So So again, we come back to explaining me. So this is what this book is. It's an attempt to explain me. As
yeah,
I
even
said,
to yourself.
What?
Even to yourself.
Right, right. Ongoing aspiration. But this is what Ayan says, that Trump is Bob in the White House. When he got in, that's what he used to say. It took a while to glimpse what the hell Ayan was saying, but Ayan's pretty perceptive. He says things that nobody else would ever say or even know to say, way ahead of me. So, yes, what do we call this book? Understanding What You Don't Know About Trump and the Tech Body. What You Don't Know About Me. I am the new unconscious. Okay, I actually say this in public. And so, and of course, that allows me to have no fucking audience, right? Which keeps me out of the noise. I'm so successful now, I don't even think I would accept being interviewed by the Android meme people or the tech body people. I'll talk to you. I ain't talking to Tucker Carlson. They're not worth it, or Joe Rogan. So am I trying to establish a, what do you call that, a secret space, an autonomous zone? Maybe that's what I'm trying to do here. I'm not participating.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And you're trying to enlarge the autonomous zone.
Yes. I like the way I keep making sense to you. That's good. Okay, let's try this. And I carry on here. The greatest disservice that was foreseen was the evocation of desperation and urgency in national, tribal, and personal identity quests that created a more violent mood in the 70s and 80s. See McLuhan's title in 1968, Mind Your Media Men or You'll Catch a Cold Environment. So I'm defining cold environment as, increasing a violent mood. The subtitle of the reversal over the overheated image. Therefore, he knew reversal was coming. So the ecstasy of the 60s is going to flip into what Lester Banks called the bland out of the 70s, the dead zone,
mm-hmm.
or planet of the dead, McLuhan said. Okay, so I say that, then my little oral repeat of this says, to have a social identity, you have to have violence. And I'm quoting McLuhan with that one. You are a fascist. You impose it on society. I'm taking the cliche idea that power is aggressive. You maintain your socially aggressive power if you want to have an identity. Establishing an identity is an act of violence. Becoming literate is a violent act. McLuhan, in one of his books, From Cliché to Archetype, quotes people fearing the literate back in the 1400s. And his quote is, where is it from? I guess Joseph Frank. Joseph Frank discusses Dostoevsky's The House of the Dead in terms which give stark, iconic, this is McLuhan saying this, in terms which give stark, iconic force to the division between the literate and the illiterate classes in a feudal society. To the peasant, the literate man is armored. Quote, you gentry, iron beaks, you devoured us. Oh, there's the swallowing up. So we're back to if to the degree we're retrieved feudal society, which McLuhan said we did by the TV age. So we have a literate and the illiterate. The liberal post-literates versus the Gutenberg post-literates in a society where everybody shares hardship of the stresses of the unknown. And the literate man is armored. It's kind of reversed now. The illiterate, the peasant, is yearning for Gutenberg values. That's the mega gang. And they're against the literate guys who are embracing the new armor, which is post-literate. So it's kind of reversed from what McLuhan's saying here. It's still House of the Dead, but the literate and the illiterate classes have flipped. And it's not just a feudal society. It's Paleolithic, pre-Paleolithic. It's post-utopian, or it's post-human. Parahuman. So we're
post-literate.
Yeah. So you you could take this quote, get our bearings in what has flipped. So you say this quote not to celebrate the quote, but to show how it's inadequate. But you're showing people what is inadequate. Now restate it or talk beyond it, and then you might get closer to what the problem is. That's basically how I'm using McLuhan.
Yes. It's for McLuhan, it's basic that tactility involves a flip. Tactility is a relation between two poles or two opposites, you could say, and emphasis can be on either one of them. And the drama of the unconscious is the
including the other.
That's right. But all of the possibilities in the unconscious are tactile relations, and these tactile relations always include the possibility of being flipped. So the flip is just another possibility in the unconscious.
So we flipped into the post-human or the android meme or the tech body. That's part of the
correct
flip.
But the flip itself comes in a variety of flavors. So the flip of the Gutenberg galaxy is always to the one or to the other. But in an electric environment, the tactility is both of those.
Yeah. In other words, can't flip, maybe. That'd be one way to look at it or define it. You can't flip.
You can't flip in the Gutenbergian sense.
Yeah.
But the whole secret of the electric or of the magnetic that develops in the early 19th century is that there is a natural flip to the world, and that can be harnessed. So the modern technologies coming out of the early electric and magnetic experiments of people like Faraday, that's what develops into everything that we have today.
Right. So that's where the tetrad is obsolete. In the traditional meaning of obsolete, it doesn't define things. And that's why I call the Android meme replay of the tetrad the pentad. There's something different in the pentadic. There's nothing. So we read up above here the drifting of rising and falling. Didn't that get said? The cliche of rising and falling?
You mean...
yeah.
On another program? Or?
No, just up above here. I just read that somewhere. The rising and falling. Maybe it's not in here. Maybe I just read it. It was maybe a review of Lewis. The endless rising and falling. Didn't I say that up here? Looking back at 161, didn't you say the cycles?
Could well be. I don't think we've talked about it today, though. I mean, we've talked about that. And basically, that's the whole dynamic of the flip,
yeah,
right? The rising and the fall.
Okay.
So there's a thousand ways in which the rise and fall can express themselves.
Yes. So just go back. Look at this sentence. The Android meme is aping us with more Jerry Springer type shows. And this is the 90s. And the audience thinks that the world's getting dumber and dumber. No, the Android meme is getting smarter and showing how humans can believe they are still humans. This is all a fighting against the fact that everything has disappeared. Every now and then, somebody from way back then will shout to me, "Hey, Bob, everything's disappeared." They remember. It comes rushing back to them 30 years later. So I think it was I read somewhere the rising and falling, and that is not what's going on. And so I call that the pentatic. I'm saying the flip is merged with something. So that becomes what for many people is very boredom, very boring. They're looking for that dramatic shift and missing the shifts of unconscious. Do I have it? We didn't do this quote. That's what we got to do next. So when I was saying that being literate, getting an identity is the maintenance of social power. That is what runs the economy now, is endless, that software abrasiveness everywhere where everybody is maintaining their identity. And advertising is geared to everybody's different kind of identities. That's what they're smart on, right? Millions of ads for millions of identities. So that's the identity crisis, the violence that's going on. Now, I'd have to say I'm indifferent to that violence.
Well, the reason violence and identity go together is that identity is naturally a plural. The unconscious has this myriad of possibilities for who you are. And being in the driver's seat seems like the driver can establish that. But once the driver realizes that all of these possibilities are possible environments that include a driver, then the whole idea of being in the driver's seat and controlling these possibilities of identity dissolves.
Yeah.
And the only way of trying to have an identity is the violent act of saying, I'm not going to pay attention to all those other possibilities.
Yeah.
I'm just going to be me. or I'm going to give up me and just be what somebody else said or what somebody else wants me to
right.
do, right? So there is a kind of violence to human being that seems to contradict intelligibility, seems to contradict freedom. And the great question that we have today is there a way of being free and being independent and being intelligent that does not turn away from the myriad of possibilities that are always below us?
Yeah, I think Joyce had a line in Ulysses, living as if every moment were your next. That means every possible role is your next.
Yeah, that's in McLuhan has that in Take Today, I believe.
Yes.
But I found it in an unpublished work, I think it was from the 1940s, living as if every moment were your next. It's, it's a typical McLuhan turn of phrase.
Yeah.
And maybe he got it from Joyce because
it is in Ulysses.
Joyce.
I don't think it's in Finney's Wake. It's too simple. It's in Ulysses.
Uh-huh. But it's a great line.
Yeah. So, and that leads to passivity, which Joyce is an exemplar of, because, you know, the pound wouldn't like Joyce's passivity. He thought you had to do something. Eliot was in between Gutenberg guy, and Lewis was pretending he had an identity crisis or that he understood your identity crisis. I can see why that's where the population is so quadriphenic. They adopt different roles, different responses to the situation, and it's okay whatever they adopt. Apathy, indifference, activism, greed, licentiousness.
That's what they hope to achieve, being okay.
Yeah, that's where they have to realize that they didn't succeed in being passive or active or greedy or whatever. You can't achieve what you choose. So there is a world. Clint was quoting Mechanical Bride today. The freedom to listen. It wasn't the freedom of you know, choice of radio content. This is a mechanical bride. It was the freedom to be have radio be imposed on you. The freedom to listen, not to make a choice. So that's getting at what we're saying here, I'm saying here, is the freedom to put up with wonderful inventions that are being sold. Okay, so let's. So here's McLuhan.
Let's read this quotation from McLuhan and see how much of it we've anticipated today.
And so this is an op-ed, smaller one, same year. This is before the media approach to inflation, which was in September. This is May 10th, 1974. And I don't know if McLuhan titled it McLuhan. You know, maybe the New York Times did. I'm not sure.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
You're sure that the New York Times did?
Yes.
I can see if McLuhan did it. He was in a playful mood. Okay, so he says, McLuhan says, one of the peculiarities of the new electronic world is to be seen here. For the very immediacy with which people interrelate electric speeds, so that's what we were talking about, the endless percept, also has the effect of reducing their private and individual identities to a very low profile. We did say that. Their identities aren't making it. There's too many of them, and they thought they had to choose one. If everybody is a nobody at a ball game, the simultaneous presence of everybody to everybody at electric speeds makes everybody a masked man. So we were talking about being passive to that effect, not making a big deal about it, because the unconscious is there's all kinds of identities happening underneath you. One of the effects of this simultaneity in dimming down private identity is the weakening of personal ethics and moral constraint in the private sectors of daily life. Yes, that's where, you know, be irresponsible, be greedy, be licentious, be antisocial, be a Nazi. All these things are the chemical body retrieving the AP, the anthropomorphic physical. You can see there's a whole movement, or been movements, like being an asshole, okay? Celebrating being an asshole. That is in your private life. So your private life cannot be, your private roles cannot have any staying power because you're always reduced to the masked man. So I see this first paragraph is supplementing what we said. So then he says, concurrently, however, it's always a however, with the loss of moral standards in these private sectors, there's a corresponding new demand for high standards of conduct and integrity in the public sector. That's what becomes the TV body, not the TV landscape, and political correctness. Political correctness is the iconography of the TV landscape, which became the TV body. You don't have that chemical body content that the television has in the chip body. There's no identity to argue over like there is in the TV body. Okay, so...
Yeah, so the TV body is sort of like the superego?
Yeah, where you can see something. Okay, that guy is Italian. I accept his mafia roots. This guy is black. I accept his ridiculous African dancing addiction. You know? See the cultures. You don't see cultures in the chip body. You just see opinions and mental postures, and usually you don't like them. Because the chip body forgot that there are nobody. The chip body allows you to communicate, be creative, be engaged in software content that was not allowed to you in the mass iconography of the TV body. Mm-hmm. Remember McLuhan said in the newspaper they would identify people, so-and-so, 36, Republican. That's how you'd be identified in newspaper articles. These old icons, that was in the radio era. Now you've got even more sophisticated, insulting, what McLuhan called Time magazine prose. Time was very good at that. coming up with insulting labels for different identities and role players. Now, most people can do that on their own. They have slang terms for certain attitudes. Like a new one that women have is mansplaining. If you reveal that you're a man and you're talking among a lot of women are around, they'll accuse you of mansplaining.
Yep.
Now, can you say womanisplaining? No, because they say, no, we never had a chance to take over and establish woman. And they're using that to take over a non-existent stage to pretend you are triumphant in. You know, a lot of feminism is just women trying to be men. Well, that includes dealing with the collapse of identity that men went through in the first half of the 20th century. Women are catching up with that. They're having their own crisis of identity thanks to these wonderful transgender people who make women think they can't be a woman anymore. You know, it's a big movement now. You know, save the woman. Which is a phrase on my chart. Save the kidney, the Dobbs quadrant. The slogan is "Save the Kidney." It's from Saturday Night Live. So you've got women trying to save. There were some lesbian couple here that rented our other house, and one of them she didn't work. The other worked, but she didn't. She spent all day long reading about this is over the last couple of years, reading about the transgender movement, insulting feminism and women. She was really upset about it. That was her whole identity, was monitoring that and fighting it and worrying about it. Who are these assholes who won't be women?
Yeah. And meanwhile, she was a lesbian.
Yes, that's right. I probably thought the woman was the ground of being, not men. The transgenders, I guess it's like the hippies or the punkers, these various beatniks that irritated the general masses. They stood out, they irritated people, and were eventually adapted to. The transgenders are trying to be adapted to, but they're the new phenomenon. I have it on my chart. I've got beatniks, hippies, yippies, yuppies, and then guppies, which is green yuppies. In the 90s, Al Gore was a guppy. The trans thing is in the, we're in the hexatic now, that the trans thing are the hated in-crowd. The in-crowd that's the newspaper world celebrates, supposedly, the liberals celebrate, the acceptance of they're trying to accept, be passive, accept this ridiculous phenomenon or ridiculous identity. And they win at it, it seems, though some people say there's a flip now coming, and Trumpism is back, that's what some people say. Biden has run his course. So that's a replay, which is what we call in page 297 of Take Today, endless replays of the tribal unconscious. Remember that phrase?
Yep.
That's what we're talking about, the tribal, specializing in one kind of unconscious, not recognizing the quadrophenia of the unconsciousness. Okay, so you got a weakening of personal ethics in the private life, and you got a lot of correctness happening in the iconic TV landscape. This reversal of values has suddenly elevated politics to the utopian level, by virtue of the rigorous and unremitting public inspection resulting from electric media. Now, what's that mean? Elevated politics of the utopian. In other words, people are being very aware, and they're not letting anybody get away with anything. Obsolete awareness. Obsolete policing. So McLuhan is satirizing. He's calling this politics to the utopian level of everybody has to be claim they're a do-gooder.
Yeah. So this is in 1974, and 50 years before, Lewis had seen this perfectly and set it out. So McLuhan is just quoting Lewis here.
Yeah.
As Lewis from 50 years before saying, here's what our present is.
Okay, here's an idea. He does his article in Atlantic Monthly in December 69 on Lewis. And in the last
right.
line, in the last paragraph, he's talking about how Lewis's art is tactile. Now, he celebrated the eye, but McLuhan says, no, it was the tactile eye. So Lewisians wouldn't understand what McLuhan meant, that Lewis was totally in tune with sculptural, tactile values evoked by television in the 50s and 60s. And then he says, so he's saying that Lewis, at his best, he stayed up with the tactility till he's relevant in the TV age. Probably why McLuhan said in 49, as TV started to happen, I've got to get back to Lewis. He was intuiting there was something tactile or TV iconic. So these issues of ethics or non-ethics, private identity and corporate identity, that's part of the TV body, which is then subject to political correctness mandates. So McLuhan will quote Lewis, replay Lewis when he's talking about the TV landscape. When he's getting into the computer and the virtual and the digital, he'll do spinning his wake. Because you don't have the defined iconic pictures that the TV medium has.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why under the impact of the new digital in the 60s and the psychedelic, he dropped Lewis and went for Joyce for a while. Even though Don Thiel would come along and say, McLuhan is really faking his Joyce fandom. He's a Lewisian cynic. So Thiel got stuck with categorizing McLuhan as a Lewisian in the end. But that's not accurate. McLuhan was adapting. He was quadriphenic. Because at the end of the 60s, when the Joycean is now fading off, he gets back to Lewis. He starts, he does a lot of essays in the early 70s around Lewis. So that's because the iconic correctness of the ideogrammic is being locked in. Under the guise of the retrieval of visual values, which was neoconservatism, which actually was a knee-jerk response, a Gutenberg response to the digital body that was coming in. So I just did a Lewisian superficial pattern recognition there, right? But you can get enough people to be interested in what I just said and think they learned something. You get what I'm saying? I'm not putting great value on what I'm saying here, even though it's pretty fucking good on a temporary level. I'm applying Dobson's five-body model, going past Finnegan's Wake. And you're digging it. You're accepting it.
Yes, well, we've discussed on other occasions, what I see is a mind actively at work, constantly asking about itself in terms of what's going on out there in the world.
Pretending there's an out there, putting on an out there.
Uh-huh. Yes. So, I mean, it's not as if there's no out there and it has to be pretended. It's that the out there is not one thing. It's multiple things.
Yeah. How do you define Finnegan's Wake? Where's the noun? Yeah, there's no noun.
Yes.
Okay, so look at the next paragraph. This reversal, now, the reversal I was saying was a TV lens, TV body, but that's long after McLuhan. So he's just talking about chemical body terms of morality or immorality. This is his Christian self looking at the paganism that's increasing. Those are chemical body categories. So he's saying that nobody's really being moral. They are, but the Android meme is growing and is projecting utopian levels of surveillance, making everybody keep a clean nose and wear their, what is it, virtue signaling, putting their virtues on their sleeves, as he talked about that in Understanding Media. This reversal has provided public and political life with a cast of representatives left over from the old order. That is, the figures in the political drama are still men of private goals and ambitions, so he's talking about the Gutenbergian content, recruited from the individualist age when politics seemed to most people to be a dirty game to be played by individuals with private ambitions. So, in a way, he's spelling out what he predicts in Cultures Are Business in 1970, the flip into neo-visual values. So he's calling this political correctness is actually a bit erroneous. He's limiting it to a retrieval of Gutenberg values, but I would say it's a retrieval of the anthropomorphic physical as just a chemical body, not anybody, any culture that has a body. Not just so he's too Gutenbergian in his limit in his criticism here. Then he says, to many people, President Nixon may well appear as a leftover from that older political era when private ethics were expected to be high, but public behavior was permissively much lower than it can ever be again. Lower than it can be. Now, here's another thing, is that there is an anarchy going on that he sometimes refers to. And this pattern is superficial. There's a bigger pattern of anarchy that's going to enhance through the 70s and into the 80s.
And I think what McLuhan is talking about here is a dialectic between different conceptions of individuality and morality.
Yep. Eye and ear. He's bringing together eye and ear in a larger tactile environment, which he spells out a few months later in the Media Approach to Environment. That article is about the ground of tactility becoming figure. So this is these two articles are written in reverse. You got to read the other one first, and then see here he's showing the superficiality of the eye-ear merger. And so there's two kinds of eye and two kinds of ear that are getting mixed up. And he's not going into that. He's keeping it simple.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So this is for people who are trying to get some sort of basic orientation of what's going on.
Yeah.
Here's one way of looking at it. That's what he's saying. But
and
of course.
And if you get it, I think you have a little ecstasy of an epiphany. You'd be able to mock what's going on because you see the hypocrisy, which he talks about in the next paragraph. Because people are trying to find a way to maintain a witty position at the cocktail party. People live for what they're going to say at parties.
Yeah, that's called identity.
Right.
Yeah, it's...
They got to come up with new ways to keep their identity charismatic, and this will disappear when the chip body takes over in 95. That it becomes translated to inner space as the content of the chip body, where people are yelling at each other's attitudes, which they pick up by ESP, which is indicated by whatever words you use. So it's a crude form of ESP based on ideas and what identities your ideas seem to represent. And you, as an opponent of that, is not going to be that identity, so you're going to mock it. So immediately the chip body became a very violent environment from 95 to 2000, and many friendships were gone because they got sucked into a new kind of cocktail wittiness in the super angel state. Now, you could transcribe that out, what I just said, and that would appeal to people. You know, this guy's got a lot of insights. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you could sum it up by saying that the world became a New Yorker cartoon.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody could be a New Yorker. It was easy because there was enough familiarity of the different archetypes and movements of old unconscious in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. All the different, quote, revolutions attempted.
Yeah.
The valuation of values.
What I see you doing when you're talking, you use these terms like 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah.
Or in 1996, this happened or whatever.
You know what that is? You know, there's neurolinguistics where, you know, a person indicates they're biased by where they look with their eyes. You know about that?
Yes.
Science?
Yeah. Yeah.
I use words and people's journalistic pattern recognition that they have in the decade dance they have in themselves. People have images. You can say 60s, they got images. 70s, images.
Mm-hmm.
These are modern poetic terms.
Yes, that's right. So you tend to use years in the sense of you're talking about something X and you want to indicate that there's also Y.
Yep.
So your particular way of doing that is to say that in the 80s there was X, but then in the 90s there was Y.
Yeah, these are the chain letter phase shifts or the decade dance.
Correct. Correct.
Again, I'm just talking about myself, aren't I?
Well, in a sense, everybody does that all the time.
Right. But it is a kind of poetry. It's not Gutenberg poetry. It's conversational poetry. It's instant pattern recognition, which is what people want.
It's your way of dancing.
Yes. That's the way I dance, verbally dance. And mental gesture and ESP. I'm assuming you get what I'm saying, which is actually what Cosmic Awareness said to me in October 8th, 1969. It was so accurate. They said, Bob, they had something called the Symbolic Project. They had 144 symbols they came up with, metaphysical symbols that meant all kinds of occult stuff and that. It was like an encyclopedia of all the previous Kabbalah systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, you have an extraordinary action in the Symbolic Project. You have a way of communicating high abstractions with a transpersonal effect, and transpersonal was intuitive ESP. So I was good at vast generalizations, that's why I liked McLuhan, and made it personal and bring in the intuitive or whatever, words that evoked a sense of what's the actual Esperanto language they lived, which was the decade dance terms and images they had. So they said I was good at expressing high something, high level or high something symbolism with a transpersonal charisma. That's exactly what I just did and what you're talking about. That's what I do. So I could go on the radio 40 years ago and just talk my way through for 33,000 hours or more.
Yeah.
I was doing Howard
well,
Stern and
Rush about.
Howard Stern and Limbaugh, they're not as good as me.
Yeah, they only can do an hour or two.
Yeah.
For you, talking 24 hours is no problem at all.
Yeah, because my audience will react to what I'm saying, and I get new patterns right from their words. That's what office hours is.
Uh-huh.
So let's see if he's going to say this about me. Let's see what happens in the next paragraph. The new political pattern demands idealism not only of profession but behavior in public figures. But this demand is made by people who are quite permissive in their private ethics. A new kind of hypocrisy has been born among those who have grown up with the new media. Now, this is not me because he's dialectic and Gutenbergian almost. He's putting on the Gutenbergian. I got multiple levels, Quadrophenian, five bodies, so I'm not subject to this criticism. A new kind of hypocrisy has been born among those who have grown up with the new media. They now demand of public figures a level of moral dedication which they feel no need to exemplify in the private sector of their own lives. Now, this is what the alt-right redid in the Android meme or in the tech body level of the chip body. This is what they talk about, not your moral life with your physical body, but the moral life of your hypocritical political correctness. They criticize the New York Times journalists for standing up for certain mental political correct attitudes, but do not live by it themselves. See, it's mental behavior here, not physical behavior. It's mental immorality or hypocrisy that McLuhan's predicting. No, he's not predicting it. This is where he's giving the last criticism, the last hypocrisy of the era when there was chemical bodies. By the 90s, when the digital takes over, there's a new hypocrisy that he didn't live to see, but I'm extending from McLuhan but beyond. And basically, it has to be the discarnate mental world, the Egyptian world he has in the review of Burroughs. It's a mental Egyptian intuitive world. That's what we're arguing over. And there's a hypocrisy there in the older legacy media, which the chip body people recognize. And that's another aspect of MAGA. See, MAGA is not a simple nostalgia. It is a resentment to ungrammatical major media. They do a lousy job of doing what they claim to be doing. They don't finish stories. They don't investigate it. They fuck up themselves. They actually are demanding you to not have maids and immigrants working for you, but they have them themselves. So that's a bit of physical, that's an example of physical behavior. But it's always about culture, use of culture. So part of this time is the interplay of cultures, which meant that people had to stand back and create rules, which was called political correctness, because everybody was merging into the mass man of no identity. So making identities is a moral activity on the mental level, but it's hypocritical because nobody can live by that. Those divisions.
That's one of the ways in which it's violent. And that's what he was talking about a page before, right?
Yep.
Or maybe it was you who was talking about it.
I was saying it, but I was getting it from this. Yeah. I was saying it before we came to the quote or after it. But we did the quote first. So a new kind of hypocrisy has been born among those who have grown up with new bodies, not new media. They now demand of the TV body a level of moral, mental gesturing and categorization, which they feel no need to exemplify in their endless tweeting, in their chip body. So they, you know, there's always an Android. The TV level is more the Android meme. The tech body is definitely a chip body extension. So they're always criticizing Trump for his errors in the Android meme TV iconography level. So he said he's going to, you know, wipe out a whole bunch of people, a lot of chemical bodies in his first, as soon as he gets in office. So everybody says, this is Hitler. He's going to be a dictator. You know what his response was? No, I'm only going to do this the first day. I will not be a dictator the second day. Which is a great response. And it's humorous, and people respond to that. And the old New York Times journalists are left fucking speechless.
Yeah.
And they're going to criticize him for lying or being hypocritical, and that's not what's going on here. He has to come up with a pattern from a different body to cancel their body attack or neurosis. You see? So it really is new bodies, not new media. And so we can apply what McLuhan's saying and just put in bodies for, and then you would have more than two. You'd have five bodies or even six. And that's the way I talk.
Yeah. So, you, I mean, one way of talking about the dynamics of the unconscious is to do it in terms of years. or decades,
yeah.
You can say, in this decade.
Now,
this
that would be TV
this...
body, because I'm using known cliche images from each decade.
Right. But you can also talk about it in terms of bodies.
Yes.
You can say, this belongs to this body, that belongs to that body.
Yes,
you can also talk about it in terms of media. You can say, this belongs to TV, this belongs to X-rays,
right.
Whatever, right? So these are different overlays, you can say,
yep.
Different forms of mapping that can be used to try to understand what's going on in the possibility land.
Your unconscious, yeah, what you're engaging.
Yeah, yeah. And this is what you're engaging in the unconscious are possibilities, not of ideas or particular things to do with your body. They're whole environments.
Yeah, you are cultures. That's right. You're wearing whole environments from culture
Correct.
To media. Now,
so this... This
as you
dynamic.
Talk, we're coming right into what I perfect introduction to what I say next. I say what you're saying. You're predicting this. This is good. But you want to say one more sentence?
Lead on. No, lead on. If I'm
listen
if
to
I'm
this.
Leading into something.
Yeah, listen to what I say. I'm 166 yeah. after the McLuhan quote.
Yeah.
As the android meme provided cover for itself by allowing humans to perceive more and more that the android meme looked and acted like them. Now, that would be a general looking for the chemical body in the media, because it's not totally chip body yet. So it is people looking for cultures and chemical body environments that people are wearing, collectivities, in the Android meme, in the virtual replay to you to make you think there is an America, there is a West or East or a European. These are all, or hippies or straight people. As the Android meme provided cover for itself, because it was moving into the chip body, out of the TV body, by allowing humans to perceive more and more that the Android meme looked and acted like them, and more it'll present whatever body you think you need, while at the same time it appeared to slowly disappear. Now that's the anxiety part, that after 30 years of this correctness of the ideogrammic and the iconic, the chip body is making it become invisible, that those categories don't work. We're not people. We're post-human. We're not bodies. We're something else that you can't visualize. So you can't visualize, so it disappears. It appeared to slowly disappear. The shrinking android meme evoked a renewed sense of anthropomorphic power in humans' chemical bodies, but we're going to have to include now the later bodies, and that's in the next paragraph. Beginning with the mood of having survived Y2K and 9/11, overcoming the fear of the landscape of chip technology, the chemical body sought out nano communities, that's chip body, online and in person, and righteously announced a new confidence in their particular favored physical bias of form. This was misidentified as the culture wars. So I'm still emphasizing the chemical body, not so much the astral body and the TV body. I'm not using those terms, but I probably do later. But it's chemical body at the beginning. And that was called jackass art, jackass phenomenon when the Internet came in the 90s. People would, target their bodies, hack their bodies in different ways. But it is not working. The chemical body, the celebration of the return of the chemical body as your new retrieval of the anthropomorphic is not going to work. And that's going to lead to the tech body. So let's see. So I say, while the chemical body sought out nano communities, so it thought it was looking for small, it went into the chip 1.0 to find likes and dislikes of the chemical body online. And then that became your community. But it was a nano community. And it was digital. And you didn't have to meet anybody physically. Though maybe you might attempt that. That would be the Tea Party attempting to apply, maybe even Trump, apply the chip body back into the chemical body. In that sense, it looks retro to the liberals. While the chemical body sought nano communities, that's the texting, and righteously announced a new confidence in their particular favorite community, it started announcing that they were transgender, and that was better than a heterosexual. New confidence in their particular favorite physical bias of form, so they're arguing over the physical. It was body wars, not culture wars. It was over what to do, what kind of shape to put the chemical body in. So, see, I'm describing the AP taking over. So then you get Frank Zingroni comes in with a useful book, The Media Simplex, which is the overlaying that you're talking about in dialectical terms. The complex and the simple is happening in the chip space. So he says, politics and economics have always operated in secrecy. So that's a top-down conspiracy, quote, theory attitude, which everybody thinks there's a lot of group manipulation going on counter to your nano community. And it's misnamed conspiracy theory. It's just everybody's operating in secrecy because they're invisible. So politics and economics have always operated in secrecy. In information circles, media gatekeepers are the functionaries of the new Gnostics. Cyberspace bandits, information high priests, chaos investors, hacker terrorists, bank presidents and IMF globalists, drug and biotech researchers, communication moguls, and sundry other infocrats, which we could say digital bodies, cross the data desert of the Internet in one-person caravans. That's really good. It's, you know, super angelic driver's seat, one-person caravans. They're putting on their community. They're pretending a bunch of people that seem to agree with them on some forum is your community. Very ephemeral. So then he says there's something fundamentally mysterious about the operations of electric process. Now, he's trying to describe the digital thing, but he's still using McLuhan TV landscape terms. So he calls electric process, but it's the tactility squared of the chip body landscape that you were describing. Every square centimeter of Earth has become a holographic point, that's a good statement, containing all of the transmissions over the face of the globe. That's him approaching the holopathic in my chart, which was written a few years before he wrote this, and he's still stuck in a more solid TV body icon. So he's only seeing one hologram. Doesn't see the holopathic. Every square centimeter of Earth has become a holographic point containing all of the transmissions over the face of the globe. There ain't no globe. The elimination of time and space in human interchange is a big enough revolution to completely change all social values. Virtualized, bodiless people can make no real society. That was the problem in the TV age. You probably would see this as a bit of a rearview mirror. A Marconi bias here, because people by 2001 are not having a problem with this virtualized bodiless reality, and they're not having a problem of making an unreal society. The discarnate realities of electric process and their great economic power may be the problem, not the solution to our futures. So that's him criticizing McLuhan, that the electric producer/consumer reality is not the solution anymore. That's because, yeah, we have a total chip body. So he is describing the chip body before he knows my stuff.
So you said there that in 2001, people didn't have a problem with this anymore. And what I see you saying there is, looked at another way, there is no problem there.
Yes.
So it's the Bob's mind tends to function through objective scenes. It's as if you're a filmmaker.
Yep.
And you're so.
That's what McLuhan said Innes did in the 50s. Innes was cinematic, and he didn't know it.
Correct. That's what he, in the later in his
yes.
Essay of
1953.
53, that's right.
So, you know, I'm doing Innes with television, not cinema. Maybe cable TV, multiple channels.
Yeah. Yeah, instead of a camera with frames, pickup camera, like a microphone.
Well, you're remote, hopping.
Yeah.
Good. The discarnate. So you see where what McLuhan tried to say in Collegiate Archetype, what he called the intermedia process. Mm-hmm. Zingroni is talking that the 70s McLuhan, but using a different term, electric process, which is only said a few times in Take Today by Barry Nevitt. So he's doing McLuhan with a little bit more advantage of, many years later of the computer world. But he's still bogged down with TV concerns, a TV body, because he keeps it in TV landscape. And he's saying it is, he sees it eroding. He knows it has something to do with the computer, but it doesn't get to the five body, which Croker does. So, and Zingroni used to criticize Croker. He read him and was bothered by him. That's probably because Croker was doing something that Frank didn't fully get. Frank is the best McLuhan commentator in the early 2000 period, because the diasporic school, they're still talking in media terms. The Neil Postmans and Bruce Powell and Lance Straight, they don't get to the digital till recently. But if you read this book, it's a good book about, and he's able to find all kinds of hypocritical situations, a lot of patterns that nobody else comes up with or don't notice. And he's got a lot of them in his book, a lot of interesting patterns. He's like McLuhan, commenting on the mundane, banal stuff of that day. Like he was talking, I know he did a paper, an editorial op-ed in the Globe and Mail or something around 2000, 1999, and he talked about, he's a university professor, and he's talking about how universities, what a fraud universities are. There weren't many professors going that far. So he was, talking about the classroom without walls and seeing the computer was, squaring the classroom with walls, and it made professorships obsolete. Mm-hmm. Now, he had tenure and all that, so he could say it, but there was no other professor, it seemed to me, going that far.
And you knew him personally, right?
Yeah, we were good friends, yep.
Yeah, so, and did he have a lively mind? Could he keep up with you?
Yeah, he was a poet, and he always could respond to what I'm saying with his own examples. Now, this was in the 90s. He was fed up with Eric, Derek, and Logan, and any other of those corny guys. He knew that they were behind. So he worked on this book for a few years, and the only guy who responded to it intelligently was Don Thiel. But Don was keeping up with the scene. It's like Don, he got a big image in the early 90s with saying, cyber culture is retrieving Finnegan's Wake. Now, that was pretty unique for his day. But by 2001, maybe he didn't have a metaphor for the post-Y2K. Well, Frank did seem to have that. So he didn't hear much of my five-body talk, but he knew that I was on to something that he recognized. So he enjoyed talking to me than to any other McLuhanite. And I even got him to become a friend of Don Thiel, because he found out I was talking to Don, so he got interested. And then he found out Don was basically the last guy he corresponded with before he died. He had a major heart attack in 1989. And he lasted once he got over that, probably, that's when he became radicalized. He got over it. And then he lasted until about 2009, another 20 years. And Don Thiel, he had his crisis when he was kicked out of the presidency of Trent University by the neocon revival. So his 60s patina wasn't working. So he read Stuart Brand's The Media Lab, saw that they were using McLuhan and Finnegan's Wake, and then he realized, I can bring back my Finnegan's Wake expertise and have a new role. But that's sort of wrapping up the end of analog media. And by 2005, 2006, when Facebook and those Twitter and YouTube come in, he dies. He dies in 2008. He can't make the transition. And then Frank dies a year later. So
and
I didn't
did,
read.
Did Don stay at Trent until he died?
No. Well, he was an honored professor.
Yeah.
You know, he taught a few courses, but he didn't like
it. But he still lived out there in Peterborough.
Yeah, it was in Peterborough, and he didn't like the universities anymore. He said, if I was young, I would not become a professor. He said it was very corrupt and stupid. He had the same idea as Frank. But people would ask him to advise them, so he would teach a little bit. But he was up against a feminist takeover that was kicking Joyce out and no longer doing English, but culture studies. So he had to talk in a department that he didn't like the name of, because he thought modernism, which was the men in 1914 were actually postmodernism, that's what the postmodern feminist academics were missing. He still thought they need to understand Finney's Wake, and I agree with him. The feminists and all these female journalists and reporters, they don't know Finney's Wake. They don't have a good handle on the chip body, because they're trying to save the chemical body woman version. And now they have lost to the transgender, which is very interesting how it snuck up. Nobody saw that people would start being any gender and that would threaten the feminists. They thought they had wrapped it up. These men, they can't beat us. We're more important than men. All right, we're the ground of the earth and all that. Boy, did they not see what was coming.
Well, that's the history of
most humans.
All humans.
Yeah. Frank, he did a couple of good books on poetry. When he went on TV Ontario on panels, he always was further out than anybody in what he said. Nobody even knew what he meant.
So was he an American?
No. He grew up across the street from McLuhan on Wells Hills Avenue. And he went to church as a kid and had mass beside McLuhan, you know, on Sundays. So he grew up with McLuhan, and he wasn't ready for university, so he dropped out, got some job work, chemical body labor, did that for a couple of years, probably realized this ain't going anywhere, so he went back to university. He was born in the 30s, say, mid-30s or something, maybe 32, 33, and so in 58, so he's 25 years old. He's back in freshman university, and I think it's at St. Mike's. And one of the first lectures he experienced was McLuhan. So he knew McLuhan as a neighbor, but he didn't have any clue what McLuhan was about. And this guy comes in and talks, and that was probably the biggest experience Ingrown ever had in his life. He talks about it, that lecture, he walked out stunned and excited. He says, holy shit, there's something to think about. Because he had a latent poetic instinct. So he was hearing the actual top poet of the day. And so he became a student of McLuhan at St. Mike's. He took courses under him. And I think he even took, Don Thiel was there. I think he even took courses with Don Thiel. So he always appreciated McLuhan. But what I remember of him in the 70s, before I knew him well, he would come in every 6 months and argue the hell with McLuhan, be a stick in the mud. And I thought he was too uptight about something. He really was bothered by McLuhan. So he writes this essay. Do you have the book, Who Was Marshall McLuhan?
Yes.
Well, there's a great essay in there by Frank where he's with McLuhan in August 79, like 6 weeks before his stroke. And he goes to dinner with McLuhan, and he talks about, Donald Sutherland comes. They went to Club 22 at Windsor Arms. And he talks about this, and McLuhan's making remarks about the people. Donald Sutherland comes out. McLuhan says actors are overpaid, nobodies. And Frank is liking what McLuhan was saying. And now he's writing them a few years later, because McLuhan's gone in a year or so, and he's regretting. He says, I should have spent more time listening to McLuhan. I argue with him too much, and I missed the boat. This is how he ends his essay. And so he's saying, in a way, he knew he had to correct that, but he found that when he taught kids in the 90s, in this period, yeah, McLuhan, when's McLuhan go? 1980. So by the 90s, Frank is trying to teach understanding media and this stuff and prop up McLuhan, and it doesn't work because the kids don't have TV and radio. They don't even know what he's talking about, so to speak, in an exaggerated way. So he recognized there was new technologies, the digital, and that's when it was happening, 95 to 2000. So he jumped in and analyzed and created a vocabulary from 95 to 2000, which comes out in this book, The Media Simplex. It's called, subtitled, At the Edge of Meaning in the Age of Chaos. So he's dealing with the chaos that McLuhan maybe didn't experience as deeply. It wasn't so obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, he knew it was chaotic in the fourth level of Vico and all that, but people weren't living in chaos. The students weren't. The digital generation is. And so that's what he means. In the age of chaos, it's become an extreme figure. So he's the only guy who takes that on, it seems, of that they call themselves the three wise men, Logan, de Kerckhoff, and Eric. They were the three prophets. They saw the value of McLuhan when nobody did. And they tried to lump Frank in, but he wouldn't have it. He knew they were a bit rearview mirror. So I would say that, just as with Don Thiel, I was the, quote, modern guy or postmodern guy that would stimulate them. And he acknowledged me in the preface. He says, like Don Thiel says, I caused his book, The Virtual McLuhan and the other ones. And Zingaroni says the same thing. I'm a big deal in his preface, in his acknowledgement.
Good.
So I'm not making it up. There's a record of my activity in the 90s when I wasn't on the radio anymore, but I was talking whenever I came to Toronto, I talked to him, and Thiel talked to him on the phone a lot. Now, when his book came out, he joined our McLuhan Institute forum, 2001-2002. And a couple years later, I bumped into him. I came back to Toronto, hadn't talked to him for a year or so, because I was involved with in New York, and he expressed his frustration with me and Nelson that we didn't acknowledge his posts. He made a few posts. I hadn't read his book. I didn't know he was quoting his book. It didn't strike me as too significant, just like what you were saying 20 years ago didn't strike me as too significant or appropriate. And he was mad at us for not acknowledging what he had done. But he had that frustration everywhere. He couldn't get reviews of his book. Finally had to get Don to do it. But he was very pissed off, and that probably caused his second heart attack in 2009.
Yeah.
Why do you laugh there? What are you laughing at?
Oh, just I was thinking, as you were talking about Frank, that he was probably reacting his whole life long to upsets to his identity.
Yeah.
That his arguing with McLuhan all the time was really an argument with himself.
Yeah. You know, he was a hip guy, but there was that alienated part of himself, which is, you know, he's not academically inclined when he leaves high school. But he couldn't do anything else, and so he had to eventually go into academia, but he had that, you know, underclass, I think, resentment against eggheads.
There's a marked parallel between Frank and Easterbrook. Both of them were out of the academic environment for a number of years and then went back in. And both of them, in Who is Marshall McLuhan, regret the fact that they had argued with McLuhan
yes.
more than listened to him.
Yeah, that's where they, you know, to me, it's an old-fashioned image because a lot of kids do this now. They don't go to university right away. But back in the day, you were a bit stupid if you didn't go on to university because you would
yeah.
be forced to work your butt off and you'd get pissed off if it didn't lead anywhere. And then you thought you didn't have the ability to go to university. You were trapped in the economic grind, and mm-hmm. that would be very pissed off. So, but what's interesting is that Easterbrook goes back, gets inspired by Innes, just like Zingroni goes back and gets inspired by McLuhan, and it triggers the poet in Zingroni.
Mm-hmm.
And probably triggers the poetic level in Easterbrook. As I understand,
well,
he wasn't your normal economist, right?
Yes.
I mean,
Innes wasn't.
Right. And he could respond to that. Now, another interesting thing is FZ, which is commonly used in the Zappa world for Frank Zappa, that's Frank's initials, FZ.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you know Zingroni, I have to spell out who I mean because they don't know Zappa or they know both, and they know there's two ways it can be FC. So here's an example of me being relevant to Zingroni. He, by 95, he said to me, my son is involved in something that I'm very worried about. He's met these people, and they've got a magazine out called Prevailing Winds, and it's all this conspiracy stuff. And he's hanging out with this guy, Patrick Formey, and he goes on about this. And then he says, do you ever heard of someone named Maeve Russell? I started laughing. I said, I'm Maeve Russell's best friend. He was shocked. What? You know about these people? Yeah, I know Prevailing Winds. I know Patrick Formey. I know what the fucking problem is for your son. So that really surprised Frank, you know, that I was right there. I was part of the scene that was bothering his son because I was tuned into what that Generation X was into. They were into conspiracy stuff, a lot of them, in the 90s. And they were retrieving Maeve Russell. I mean, you know, I was there the day Maeve Russell died, you know, at her home. Well, at the non-home, whatever it was, at the clinic. But so I was talking to your friend Richard Altman a week or two ago. And he says, you know, Bob, you know who I met? No. I met Zingroni's son. And I said, what's his name? I think he said Michael. And he said, I had a very interesting conversation with him. And I said, well, that's pretty timely because just about 3 months ago, I decided to find out what happened to Patrick Formey. I couldn't even remember his last name, so I have some of these Prevailing Winds from the 90s. So I looked up in my library and found an early one where he was editor because he dropped off the scene pretty quickly and let these other guys take over. And so I Googled him. It turned out he was a very controversial guy. He did one scene after another. He worked for an Oliver Stone movie. He did some acting here and there, you know, probably as an extra. And then he got some money, and he went into some – started growing grass and got busted a couple of years ago. So there was lots in the media about him right then. So I started Googling I got to find out what Frank's son's name is. So I look him up, get his obituary, get some of the kids' names. Then I find out his daughter had died a few years ago, but she's married to a guy, Stephen Katz. So I look up Stephen Katz, some name like that, and he's a professor at York. I said, well, that makes sense. And Frank got his son into into academia. So I message him through Facebook, and he responds. And he talks about, yeah, I knew Frank Zingroni. He was my professor, blah, blah, blah. But the Stephen Katz you're talking about is not me. That's another guy who I knew. I knew a little bit, and I knew Frank's daughter. So I was really close to getting the right guy, but I missed the mark by an inch, and that was 2 or 3 months ago. And then all of a sudden, Richard finds the guy out of the blue. After I haven't talked to Richard in 5 years, he's got the answer for me. Now,
So I
messaged Mike Zangroni. It may not be the right guy, but he's in Toronto. There's not that many. I haven't heard back, though. Maybe he isn't the guy. But I'm trying to get to the son and to see what happened to him dealing with this Patrick Formey, who somehow was Zingroni's neighbor, I think. So the neighbor hijacked his son for a while. Anyways.
But you talked about this Formey guy as sort of a Hollywood figure.
No, well, he moved to the States in the early 90s. Maybe he went to university or something, and he's living out in California, and he gets into the conspiracy May Brussels stuff and starts a magazine. And I was looking at a couple of later issues, and Oliver Stone is writing for him. So Oliver Stone liked this magazine because this is in 92, right when he's doing JFK. So he's monitoring the conspiracy genre. Finds it at May Brussels, but she's gone. She died in 88, so he gets the after image, and that's Patrick Formey and John Judge and Dave Emery and these guys. And they're in the magazine, and Peter Dale Scott, a Canadian, a son of the famous Canadian Fred Scott, F.C. Scott or whatever, the poet. He was a big professor out in Berkeley, Peter Dale Scott, and very big, respected top-down researcher. So
he's
all these
still
guys...
Alive.
What?
He's alive now. He's writing for anti-war magazine.
Yeah, he does the conspiracy stuff, still does it. He does really good research, a good friend of May Brussels. And so these are the guys that Patrick is hanging out with in 92, and that's how he met Oliver Stone, through the charisma of the magazine. So he drops out of the magazine by 93 or something, and then he goes through Oliver. He tries to get a gig as actors, and he doesn't make it, but he's in a few movies. He's got an IMDb, as an extra or something.
Yeah.
So I just answered something you said. What did you bring up at the end there? Patrick Formey, Oliver Stone? Oh, Hollywood. Oh, why would he be in Toronto? Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know how he got to the States. But he's living there. Maybe he married someone. And he's, you can Google him, Formy, Patrick Formey, Formy, and look at he became a problem for his neighbors up there in Humboldt County. He was growing marijuana and dealers were coming in. And he was remaining above it all, but disturbing the quiet community there because all these people were driving up and down the highway nearby. That was written up in the newspaper. That was a few years ago. So I'm trying to find out where he is today, because if I get in touch with him, I can trigger his past in detail, because I know what he was inspired by. So I'd like to see what Zingroni's son would have to say.
Yeah, a whole network there.
Yeah, and Zingroni got what he deserved. He used to talk about conspiracy in a respectable way, like this quote here, that economics and politics is all flooded with secrecy. That's what the kind of stuff he would say on TV Ontario. And so his own son got trapped by the more extreme version of what he was not afraid to talk about.
Yeah.
But there again, if he ever brought up anything, I was right there. I had the goods, whatever he brought up. Yeah, in his essay in the collection of speeches at the McLuhan Conference in March 98. Do you have that book, The Legacy of McLuhan?
No.
The conference that Fordham was celebrating the 30th anniversary of McLuhan there in 97-98. So I have that book, and my essay's in there, and Frank's in there. And Frank says in his introduction, the difference in the McLuhan world is those that are in the Finning's wake and recognize its importance and those that don't. So when he wrote that, addressing the Lance Straits and these guys that weren't aware of Finnegan's Wake at all, I know he was thinking of me and him. We were the Finnegan's Wake guys, you know, and all the dummies were not Finnegan's Wake people.
Yeah, well, you, as long as I can remember any sort of contact with you, you've always said that Finnegan's Wake is the key to Marshall McLuhan.
Yep. And, you know, I have Chad started a there's this young girl who heard me talk to Zappa. She's a 22-year-old in Italy, in Rome, and she discovered Zappa in January. And so within 5 months, she had this incredible website going and a lot of people joining in. And she's rapidly became an incredible archivist of Zappa. Well, she discovered me and said, holy shit, here's a guy who talks about Zappa in a way I've never heard before. So she started celebrating me and talking to me. And then Chad saw this. So he made a Facebook page with my 36 episodes on London radio with Ben Watson, who did a book on Zappa. And it's very good dialogue. It's basically his Marxism, his British culture, versus my North American McLuhanism, that we debate McLuhan versus Marx via Zappa. And it's very good what we did. Well, Chad took all that old radio archive and made great inventoried YouTubes. Now, the thing about YouTube is, lately, people all over the world can listen to anything because it's all translated into their languages. YouTube's
right.
Translation is really improved. And so you got all these people around the world listening to me and Ben talk very sophisticatedly about Zappa in their language. You know, it's in English, but they can read it and follow it. So in 1 month, we had like 5,000 viewers on YouTube. After 2 months, we now have 14,000 viewers. Chad says, and he's well-versed in all this stuff, he says it's the fastest-growing website he's ever seen on YouTube. So they're really digging my talk about Zappa, but let me give you a few samples of what I do. So someone would say... let's see. I start talking about, me and Ben talked about this 20 years ago, how Zappa completed Finnegan's Wake, you know, musically. So somebody says, well, I've read Finnegan's Wake for many years. I was obsessed with it, but can one finish it? Can you finish Finnegan's Wake? So look at what I said. Yes, once one has read and understood Eric McLuhan's The Roll of Thunder in Finnegan's Wake, 1997. Now, I'm saying this to a Zappa guy, to an audience that doesn't know any of this stuff. This guy did Finnegan's Wake, but he's unique. But I'm now writing for everybody, that the 10,000 people watching this. I said, yeah, you can finish it once you've read Eric's book, and you would have gotten the big picture and many epiphanies. Then you read Marshall McLuhan's books and see what he did with Finnegan's Wake once he had finished it, finishing quotes. All of McLuhan's work is a translation of Finnegan's Wake and is Applied Joyce. And I have that in quotes and then McLuhan in brackets. That's what McLuhan said. He was doing Applied Joyce. Now, this is what I'm doing. I'm talking my other holy offices to the Zappa world. And, you know, I'm getting all kinds of funny responses to this because they don't. They don't even know what I'm talking about. So they talk about the American. Somebody said, Zappa musician said, Zappa was ultimately an American. So American. And so somebody says, I don't think he was completely American. I don't think that. I don't think he was completely American. So I come in and say, to be an American in quote, is to be schizoid. To be free and to have rules. Because Zappa, this guy was saying Zappa was so free. He was so American. He was acting out the American dream of total freedom way beyond norm. And I'm saying, well, no. you're noticing there's something about Americans that's not just being free. So I said, it's schizoid. It's to be free and to have rules. And I said, Zappa acted that out. Then I said, America is schizoid because it's the only country in history that was founded on the printing press alone. Marshall McLuhan explained this situation many times in his books. So I'm dropping in McLuhan, and then they're talking about what me and I say he's America's greatest composer and the greatest composer of the 20th century. So someone says, no, what are you talking about? There's Prokofiev, Stravinsky and Webern. He names all his early 20th century guys. Zappa's nowhere near those guys. And I say, not true. Zappa's main influences as a post-John Cage composer, and he did cite Cage as an influence, but he's post-John Cage. Zappa's main influences were people. I put people in quotes, in brackets. He said he didn't like people, but he's influenced by sports, country music, the news, his girlfriends, and fellow band members. This is why he was an original. And then this is after I say earlier that where is this?
So you're looking at the website now?
No, I save my remarks. I'm just running down my inventory of my – I've answered a lot of different questions. And I don't have all of them, but the one I'm looking for it doesn't seem to be here. I remember I missed this one, didn't gather it. I'd have to go back to the site and find it. But what I say is Zappa was, music was not audio anymore. McLuhan, as Zappa regarded society, like McLuhan, everything we do is musical. So Zappa was an anthropologist, a historian, a news junkie, science fiction fan, and name all these non-musical arts. I said, that's what Zappa was. And that's why he's the greatest composer. He didn't stay specialized in music. He was running for president. He was doing everything. He was acting out, fitting his wake, and what McLuhan did. And so I'm stating that as what a composer is. And, of course, these kids, that's not fucking music. That's anthropology. They don't get it. And so then I pushed the envelope by saying, not only did he do that, he was not influenced by musical people other than John Cage, because he, and I named everything that Zappa said he didn't like. He hated sports. He hated country music. He hated the news. He didn't like his girlfriends. And he was bothered by his fellow band members. I'm listing all the things he doesn't like as his influences. Now, there's your diachronic. I'm including the other. So I'm saying things that is way beyond what normal Zappa discussion is. So I'm very proud of it. And everybody's reading it, or supposedly, getting all these views. They're saying, what the fuck is this? And so there are the naysayers are starting to come in. And say, no, you're fucking nuts.
Well, you can swing with naysayers.
That's right. That's what I'm waiting for. I'm good at it. So just like on the radio show. So that's what I'm doing, though. I brought this up to illustrate how you can use Finnegan's Wake, you know, in all kinds of fields that people don't know. So I'm actually saying we know it's a cliche, you can't finish Wake, but I'm saying you can. If you get the media dynamics that we use, we go post-Finnegan's Wake, you don't have to fucking be there appreciating the music of Finnegan's Wake or studying the semantic meanings in each line, right? There's a larger picture. Basically, Finnegan's Wake is a product of radio. The whole Men of 1914 are products of radio. So I don't have to read their works. I do and will, but we're dealing with 100 years later. We're dealing with the tech body.
Yeah. Well, if we wanted to characterize what we've talked about this morning, you could say that everything has been around the image of the collection of personalities.
Yes.
That make up the individual.
That's what I show on my chart. I have the top 10 individuals, and I say, this is you. This is what you're made up of. These are the top personalities, not the bullshit ones. That's everywhere. You're made up of that, too. But to create a simulation of an academic detachment, study these people. They're worth it. Of the personalities that you're made up of. Yeah, that's part of the meaning of the tiny note chart. And, of course, these are people that mate and merge with the media. And the ground is always holeopathic. So LaRouche and May Brussel are holeopathic radio/satellite. McLuhan and Zappa are holeopathic TV/satellite. Thompson and Krishnamurti are holeopathic computer/satellite. Then Croker is satellite squared. And then I'm Rumpelstiltskin and anthropomorphic physical. Anyways, that's how I have the people. It's me and Garrett in the fifth quarter. But you're exactly right. Okay, carry on. What would you say? What are you trying to say here?
Well, one thing I'm trying to say is that we're nearing the end here.
Yeah, this is the last sentence. We're going to give you the last thought.
Well, no, I already said my last thought, that what we talked about were all of these personalities, and the goal is their dialogue.
And that is what Joyce is showing with Finnegan's Wake. He's got every kind of personality in every medium, you know, in the book. This is what you're made up of. So that's you know, what is it? Carpenter says that they became what they beheld. I contain multitudes.
Yeah.
And Joyce, it really expresses, since that was coming, and no one knew that, but it was coming, he really painted it well with Finnegan's Wake. It's such an accurate portrayal of at least the last half of the 20th century. And McLuhan was so right to bounce off it. Hey, you agree?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
You salute? Okay, well, excellent. I think that that was good. How far did we get? To 167, man. That's good.
Yeah, maybe two or three pages.
Yes.
Yeah, that's more than we have been making, so that's good.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you very much, and we'll
you
see
too,
what
Bob.
Kind of views we get.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'll talk to you later.
Good, Bob.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye.